Hi, this is Dr. Fader. Nancy, if you're there, I need the website to get onto.
Okay, I'm here.
Great. Where do I go?
InstantTeleseminar.com.
Say again.
InstantTeleseminar.
Can you spell that first couple of letters?
Yeah, InstantTeleseminar.
Got it. InstantTeleseminar.com members.
Yes.
How do we decide? I got that. And so now I need, where do I need to go here? My slides? No, my events.
Yes.
And down to control panel, yeah?
Yes.
See, I remember.
It's all coming back to you now.
It's all here. And then to go to my slides, I go up to slides on the top bar. And I'm taking control.
Yes.
And what do we have, 90 minutes? Is that where we're at?
We have 2 hours.
I have 2 hours. Okay, great.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, I'm here. This is perfect. And it's only 5:59. So
you're
I can just talk on this line. Is that right?
Yes. You just talk on this line. Control your slides the way you're doing there. And after your slideshow is over, I will field questions to you.
All right. Well, I'm ready to go whenever you want to introduce me.
Okay.
I want to wait till 6, I guess.
Yeah, I have one more minute.
Okay.
Busy day today?
Yeah, I had emergencies starting the day at 7:30 or 8, and I just finished one. So I've got
gosh.
A whole pile of charts to do after this. And a meeting. I got an 8:30 meeting.
Wow.
Life in the big city. But I really enjoy doing this. I really love the opportunity. It makes me think, so thank you.
Well, you're welcome, and I appreciate the information, personally.
Good.
Okay, I'll go ahead and make my announcements. Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us at MomsFightingAutism.com. We're so happy you're here with us tonight. I'm your moderator, Nancy Bernotitis. I wanted to let you know just a couple of housekeeping things before we get started. If you're logging in through the website, you'll see a blue box that says, listen in, ask a question, slides. That is where you would click to submit a question for our presenter tonight. You will also click the slides tab to see the slideshow when it begins. It takes a couple minutes for it to connect, so don't worry, it will connect. And then once the slides are up, you can synchronize the slides with either your phone or the webcast. Audio by clicking the button at the bottom of the slideshow, and that way you won't get a delay. Be sure to mute your computer if you're listening via the phone so you don't get an echo. If you're listening in by telephone, I will let you know in a little bit how you can raise your hand and ask a question directly of our presenter. That's kind of fun. Okay, without further ado, tonight our topic is how do we decide what to do for our kids with Dr. Josh Fader. And I'll tell you a little bit about Dr. Fader before I introduce him here. Dr. Fader specializes in neurobehavioral medicine, applying DIR floor time with families and in schools. He does research, teaches, consults, and hosts support groups for professionals and families. Dr. Fader sits on the BRIDGE Collaborative, which stands for Bond, Regulate, Interact, Develop, Guide, and Engage. It's a community-wide effort for early identification and intervention in San Diego County. He serves as Medical Education Director for the Rady Children's Hospital Autism Research Work Group and has served on the Autism Committee and on the Medications and Autism Panel of the American Academy of Children and Adolescent Psychiatry. Dr. Fader reviews grants for the Organization for Autism Research and the National Foundation for Autism Research and is a commentator on Valerie's List, a web-based information service for autism and related disorders. Welcome, Dr. Fader.
Well, it's great to be here again. So tonight, I want to talk about how do we decide what to do for our kids. And I already have a whole bunch of questions that you sent in earlier. I don't think any of them have exactly to do with this topic, but with those and the other questions that come in later, I'll be happy to field whatever I can to the extent that I'm able. But let me kind of run through some of these for a little while. It's not that long. For me, it's not very many slides. We'll take it as it goes, and since we have 2 hours, I think we'll do okay. So I am the Director of Research in the Graduate School at the Interdisciplinary Council on Developmental and Learning Disorders and Assistant Clinical Professor in the Department of Psychiatry at UCSD School of Medicine, as well as doing all those other jobs that we just mentioned. Doctors are supposed to have disclosures about what they do and how they get paid. I think everybody should be doing that as well. And so you should know that I make my living by seeing patients in the office. And I was telling Nancy just before we got on the line here, I've been seeing patients all day from 8 to 6, pretty much solid, a little bit of teaching in between, online teaching like this with the grad school. But that's what I do. I'm supposedly a quarter-time employee of ICDL as the director of research. I think it's more than that. But with them, I do teaching, research, and advocacy statewide and nationally. I also get a little bit of income, very little this year, for time spent doing pharmacogenetic research activities. My Bridge Collaborative UCSD research used to pay something, but the grant ran out, so now I get lunch every once in a while. So the questions I have for us tonight are, what does research tell us about some of these interventions? What does clinical experience tell us? What interventions are right for each of our kids and for our unique families? Kind of an impossible question, but I just want to think about how we answer that for ourselves. And then how do we organize them into a real plan? And I'll give you a framework for doing that. There's a wide array of symptoms, as you know, and I've just listed a few of the usual things that come up in everyday life when we're talking about autism and related disorders. I'll say them, since you might not be able to read the slide that well, but activity and overactivity, problems with attention and focus and distractibility. In fact, if you saw my medication talk last month, a lot of these same things are taken right from there. They're the things that people come in with: anxiety, panic, fears, problems with thinking and cognition, problems with communication and language, especially nonverbal gestural communication, which is so vitally important from early on, depression, poor self-esteem, mood instability, aggression, self-injurious behavior. I kind of lump all that together, although it's a bit of over-lumping in some ways. Motor planning problems and problems with motor tone, whether it's very low motor tone, a lot of people kind of laying around like a lox, kind of flopped over the chair, or too stiff. OC means obsessive-compulsive type symptoms, rigid thinking, perseveration, meaning you're thinking about things over and over and over again, or doing things over and over and over again. Some people like to think about that as self-stimulatory, and there is a note repetitive movements as something that we think about as well. Reciprocal interaction, which is kind of at the heart of the problem a lot of times with autism spectrum disorders. Sensory sensitivities, which I think many of us are familiar with. Tics, twitches, those kinds of things. Safety is a big one that comes up. People who run off or hurt other people or hurt themselves. Sleep is another big one. I can't tell you how many people, you probably know, if you're not sleeping or your child's not sleeping, you're not sleeping, everybody's suffering terribly. And so that's another thing that comes up. And again, those are just some of the kinds of symptoms within the wide spectrum of autism spectrum disorders that I think about on a daily basis. And, of course, there are a dizzying number of therapies that people use. Discrete trial training, fast forward, another auditory integration training, DIR floor time, and I'll talk a little bit more about that, hyperbaric oxygen, music therapy, picture exchange communication system, otherwise known as PECS, pivotal response training, and other kinds of naturalistic behavioral kinds of approaches, occupational therapy, rapid prompting method, relationship development intervention, the CERTS model, secrete and sensory integration and sensory processing, social story, speech and language therapy, the TEACH method, anti-yeast therapy, dietary interventions, vitamins and other nutritional supplements, medications, which is what I talked about last month, and many, many more. Lots of different things. And the old school, as some of you know, been around the block with autism for a couple decades, like me, used to be educational placement was kind of the thing that a lot of people did for people with autism, get them into a school program, and basically that's kind of a didactic way of approaching autism. If you can teach the person something, that's what works. And behavioral therapies very much spun out like cognitive behavioral therapy, but in a much more refined form, are kind of grew up with the educational interventions as well. Again, as many of us know, and discrete trial training, of course, and in applied behavioral analysis is famous for studies and research showing that you can teach people to do things. We'll talk a little bit more about that and the newer varieties of behavioral therapies. Speech therapy, again, there are ways to do that. The old school way was getting people to say words and kind of maybe withholding rewards until they said the word or an approximation, giving people scripts so that they might be able to participate with other kids about, you know, what do you say when you're in a certain situation. Again, there are advantages and disadvantages to that kind of older approach, and I think speech and language therapy has really grown since the older days. Occupational therapy used to go towards kind of hand-over-hand, helping someone learn to do things and use their bodies that aren't working very well for them, everything from writing to throwing things. And again, a very kind of hands-on approach and top-down in the sense of dictating and telling people what to do. And then medication through the years has mainly been used for aggression, self-injurious behavior, almost like anesthetizing people. So that's kind of the old school. The recent twist, of course, many of us know about, and this is really what we're here to talk about today, all the biomedical interventions, all the supplements and diets and those kinds of things, sensory integration, occupational therapy, recognizing the huge range of individual differences among people and how they respond to various senses, the five outside senses, right, touch, taste, smell, hearing, what did I forget, vision, and the internal senses like proprioceptive and vestibular sense, so your ability to know where your body is in space and know whether you're in motion, those kinds of things. As well as when we think about individual differences, we'll talk a little bit more about it, there are lots of other things to think about in terms of motor planning, communication, visual, spatial function, and executive function. And now the more recent relationship-based interventions, which came in large part from the infant mental health world and have really enriched what we do with our people on the autism spectrum. So we need new ideas, of course, or we're not going to be able to move things forward, but there's a real caveat emptor, right? We need these ideas because these are complex problems, and complex problems require complex multi-part interventions. And really, every idea seems to have a germ of truth. Whenever somebody comes up with an idea, it usually doesn't come straight out of the air. I guess some of them seem to. But most of them, you know, people have an idea of some sort of metabolic or psychological or other kind of theory about why it might work. And so that's good. We need to have these ideas, and we need to check them out. But the problem is when people become just believers of things without really studying them to see if they really work, or if they become businessmen about them and they're mainly making their living that way, a lot of times they leave behind science and good judgment. And we need research and we need good judgment in order to be able to make good choices for our kids. So as an example, the pharmaceutical industry has come under fire in recent years for suppressing negative studies about medications. And so we've gotten a little bit more transparent with clinical trials being logged ahead of time so that everybody's aware that a certain trial is being done and people want to know what happened, so you can't just bury it if it didn't come out right. But, of course, one would do that if you're a big company, perhaps because you don't want negative information coming out about a medication, and because you're in business, you're selling the medication, you just want to get sales. So that's one thought. There have been believers in certain kinds of treatments, and I understand why there are believers. For almost every idea that comes up, there's somebody who seemed to get better, and maybe they did, and maybe it worked, and I don't know, I'm not God, but the fact that a couple of people got better doesn't mean that it's good for everybody, but you get people who are big believers, and then they feel like everybody should have that particular kind of treatment, and then they're not really thinking about and using good judgment about whether it's actually going to work for other people. So how do you assess a therapy? Well, you know, you think about where the therapy was born. Try to find out, did it come out of a lab? Were there legitimate people kind of developing it? And then you have to decide, well, who's legitimate? I mean, some people really suspect the regular medical community of just turning a blind eye to autism and just kind of relegating it to, you know, disorder, not even thinking about people as people, but thinking about them as disorders, or just not being humane or even appropriate in trying to find solutions for people who, you know, truly need them, and instead telling families things that are generating hopelessness instead of hope. So that, you know, the medical community has certainly been legitimately lambasted for that at times. I've certainly run into that at times myself. But there are other people who are out there who might have an idea, but they really don't know much about science or how to do good research and maybe trying things to prove that their treatments work, and they really don't know how to do that in a scientific way. And so the information that they give may not really tell us what we need to know. When people are guaranteeing results, I always find that suspect. I certainly don't guarantee results with the things that I do with treatment, including things like floor time and medication. But you try to, you know, move forward, and again, we'll talk about the process of trying to do that. Follow the money. Lots of times, you know, I hate to be too cynical, but you want to know how people are paid and why. For instance, are they getting paid to put your child into a particular program because that program wants to have more people in it, and so they're paying the people who refer a fee? You know, that colors the referral process, for instance. Follow the money. Find out how people are paid. That's the whole disclosure thing I talked about earlier. And then research. You want to look for open sources of research where people are allowing you to look at their product and study it. So it happened with Fast Forward. It's a good example where it was really nicely designed and developed by Paul Talal and colleagues, but then it became owned by a company and sold, and then the research really was limited on it when it came to things like autism afterwards. But it was, of course, being used for people on the spectrum right and left. And it may be actually quite helpful for some people, but the problem is that when you close down research and it's no longer open, that's very problematic. You want legitimate peer review. So, and that too, I mean, this is a muddy area, right? So people may have research articles in very well-respected journals only to find out that later on it wasn't as good as we thought. So the research surrounding the vaccine controversy was thrown out, and then the Wakefield's colleagues who were on the paper with him stepped away from it after kind of learning more about that. Now, some people may feel like he was poorly treated, but at the same time, people haven't been able to repeat that research, and so repeatable research is also important. The method by which things are researched is important. And does that mean that parents, that we have to become experts in research? Well, maybe, maybe not. It probably behooves us to get a little bit schooled in that. And then the other thing is there's a lot of unscreened anecdotes, right? If you go to the Internet, we'll talk about this with marijuana later on, people will say, you know, it all gets better, you know, it gets better, my kid got better, he's cured, you know, all those kinds of things. You always hear those things, but then when you actually look at the children or try to look at it a little bit more closely, that may or may not, in fact, be the case. So in terms of knowing how to make a decision, what we're really talking about is the idea of informed consent. And what is that about? That means you have the information about a number of different interventions, hopefully everything reasonable that's out there, the risks, the benefits, all those kinds of things, and then you try to sort through that and figure out what you can do reasonably for your child. And the point is that we deserve to know what's out there. Don't let people hide it from you. Oftentimes, schools or government agencies, insurance companies will try to limit the information that families get about treatments. The managed care debacle of starting about 20 years ago, insurance companies would tell doctors not to tell their patients about certain kinds of treatment. Totally unethical practice. You know that it happens at schools because schools say, of course we can take care of your child in the district because they're federally mandated. They're not going to tell you about another program that might be better somewhere else. I got to tell you, in medical ethics, doctors are supposed to tell patients if they think there's somebody who can treat a certain condition better. Like for me, when somebody says, Fader, you're a doctor, why don't you give my kid medicine for their ear infection? I mean, I do some pretty fancy stuff with some psychotropic medication, but I won't treat an ear infection. I'm like, go to somebody who does that better. You know, I'm not the person who should be doing that. And that's really how that should be. Government agencies, same thing. Oftentimes, they'll have their pet programs that they're using. They're not going to tell you everything that's out there. Try not to let people hide information from you. The other thing is that we deserve to know the benefits and what proof there is or isn't for these supposed benefits of the treatment. So, of course, people hawking their treatments say, of course, these are great. You know, the benefits are wonderful. But then you're trying to look for proof that it's really there, not just advertising. So there are a lot of people, for instance, who advertise all kinds of things, certain kinds of brain scans, stuff like that, for which other people haven't been able to repeat the research that is claimed by the organization saying, oh, yeah, this scan will tell us exactly what to do with your child. You know, when that's the case, you kind of need to know that the research is limited and what that means. And you may still want to do that treatment. You still might want to try it out, but you just deserve to know how much proof there is or isn't. And then you need to know the risks. And that's been a big problem with people. I think oftentimes trying out medications or certain kinds of complementary or alternative medicine practices where they really have the people practicing them don't really understand the risks, and they're getting into territory that can be dangerous for our kids. So IV chelation is a good example, but even oral chelation, unless it's handled very carefully, can be quite dangerous. IVIG is another one. I think I talk about that later, but it, you know, very, very significant potential risk. Certainly medications have potential risks as well, and they often scare us away, but I think judicious use of medicine can certainly be helpful sometimes. So we need all this information so we can make truly informed decisions based on our own family culture and values. So even if you have an intervention that could help a certain child in a certain family, that doesn't mean it fits for you. So a great example would be for a family that wants to use a very structured kind of intervention, if that's not really how they operate, and they're not going to be able to follow through, and it's just going to be frustrating for them, that might not be a good fit for that family culture with that family values. On the other hand, a more open-ended kind of, maybe the relationship-based kind of approach might be a better fit for them. Or alternatively, there may be some people for whom that sort of more loosely organized, based on principle kind of approach really doesn't feel right, and they really, parents, for instance, might really need to have a little bit more structure to know where they are, where they're going, and how they're going to get there. So every family is going to be a little bit different. And so given all the information, you have to kind of figure out for yourself and your child what's going to be useful for you. The elements of informed consent are important to understand. So in any treatment, certainly in medication in the field of medicine, you're actually supposed to know all these things. And, you know, people talk about it in the medical journals when they talk about avoiding malpractice. But I think a rare person who goes to a doctor, and the doctor actually goes through all these things. I have a dummy sheet where I make sure to go through it when I'm starting medications with people, and then I have an update piece at the bottom so I can say, have we done all this? Have we done all this? But you want to know what the diagnosis is, and even more important because, as you know, with autism spectrum disorders, a lot of times people have a very unclear diagnosis or a couple different diagnoses, nonverbal learning disorder, sensory integration problems, maybe a seizure disorder, Fragile X, and then there's like an autism spectrum diagnosis on top of that. So that doesn't necessarily tell us exactly what to do, but it's important to try to talk about what we think we're dealing with. But the target symptoms are really important. And again, in my medication talk, I talk more about this. But for any kind of treatment, target symptoms are the issue. And those are the kinds of things that I listed earlier. And there are plenty more than that, like anxiety and overactivity and perseveration and, you know, communication, reciprocal interaction, all those kinds of things. And then a treatment protocol. If you're going to do some sort of treatment, what's the protocol? How are you going to do this? you going to have therapy 3 times a week? Are you going to be doing floor time sessions several times per day? Are you going to be getting extra help in the house for this particular thing? What's it look like? And what are the alternative treatments? Have you considered other things? And what would happen if you don't do any treatment? If you don't do this particular treatment, what do we think might happen? And so this should be the clinician working with us as families, working with you. I jump between being a clinician and being a parent because I'm both, and so forgive that. But, the clinician should be talking with you about what the results might be of no treatment, talking about the potential side effects. And we're not just talking about medication or supplement side effects. All treatments have potential side effects. Psychotherapies have potential side effects. Behavioral training has side effects sometimes. Everything can have side effects. Now, for medicine, with the FDA, we usually are saying that what we're doing is experimental because there isn't a whole lot of FDA-approved treatments for marketing for autism, really just a couple medications for irritability, Risperdal and Abilify. But beyond that, we do so many different things. And I would hazard to say that almost all our treatments end up feeling experimental. When you think about it, every individual is a different person, and so whenever you do any kind of intervention, you've got a new experiment in nature, as a colleague of mine used to say when I was first learning psychiatry back in the early 80s. Late 80s. Consent and assent. So consent means who's going to say it's okay to do. It's families who say that. Parents who typically say that for their kids, even their adult kids, if their kids can't make those decisions for themselves. Assent means talking with, if possible, the person, the child or adult child, who's got an autism spectrum disorder, and talking with them about what you're going to do and seeing if if they're okay with going along with it. And there are some people who really aren't able to participate in that kind of discussion, and there are plenty of different levels of understanding and how one might talk about those, and we're not going to go into that a whole lot, but it really helps to have the buy-in of the people who we're trying to help, as I'm sure you know. And then for me, I always think about comments, questions, and concerns, and I use the phrase, we're going to track this closely, because that's what you need to do. And really, my bottom line at the end of all this, in case you don't stay on long enough, is that tracking things closely is the key to figuring out whether you're moving forward. The research, so you know, is always mixed. And why is that? Our kids are all different. We know this. When you've seen one child with autism, you've seen one child with autism. Same with adults, obviously. And like I said earlier, everybody's genetically different. So if you're trying to do research about a particular intervention on a group of children, the kids are much more mixed and mixed up than a more pure population, for instance, of adults with a major depressive disorder or obsessive compulsive disorder. Even kids who don't have autism spectrum disorder usually come in with about 3 or 4 different diagnoses, and autism just makes that even more complicated. Moreover, whatever the treatment is, as we said earlier, it might not be a good fit for the child or for the family, and so we can't just do what one study says might help. It's really hard to deal with this problem that we will never have great research to tell us exactly what to do with each child. Over the past 15 years or so, a concept has emerged that we call evidence-based practice that helps us try to grapple with that problem, how to respond to these uncertain circumstances, while maintaining autonomy for families to choose what they think is best. It began in 1996, as far as I know, with a letter to the British Medical Journal by a doctor named Dr. Sackett. Kind of culminated in a way in 2001 with a statement by the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Sciences, which adopted this idea of evidence-based practice. And I'll go through that just a little bit. In the beginning, Sackett called this the conscientious, explicit, and judicious use of current best evidence in making decisions about the care of individual patients. So he wasn't really talking about it so much as informed consent issue as much as weighing the best current evidence with your own clinical judgment. And what he worried about was that people would take a paper and say, gee, this research says we can do this, we need to do that with everybody, which is a mistake because, as we said, it doesn't fit. Or alternatively, believing in something, like, again, we talked about earlier, believing in something without having any good research and doing that, and that might not be helpful either. So he talked about this balance between good judgment and having some research to inform that good judgment. Later on, it was kind of expanded to really three things, by adding the element of family culture and values, and really opening up from evidence-based medicine to the idea of evidence-based practice, which means all clinical interventions, not just ones that come out of the field of medicine. And then placing that in the context of informed consent. Now, a lot of times, the phrase evidence-based practice is confused with other terms. Evidence-based intervention is sort of synonymous. An evidence-based practice might be a little bit more philosophical. An evidence-based intervention probably means that the intervention is part of evidence-based practice. So that's almost semantics. Evidence-based research, however, is a little bit different. That refers to research without necessarily referring to clinical judgment or family or informed consent. So when you see people saying, we're only going to do things with evidence-based research, you have to be aware, because that means that somebody who says, well, I've got research that shows this can happen, we can teach people to point to the green square, for instance, therefore everybody's got to do that, and it takes away any judgment on what you can do, whether it makes sense to teach this person to point to the green square or not. Evidence-based treatment refers to research on specific treatments, again, usually without the benefit of clinical judgment or family culture and values or informed consent. So in a very similar way, you are very limited when you start speaking that way. So again, when you see legislation that goes out about trying to get rights for people with autism to get treatments, things like that, you have to be careful when they use phrases that limit your ability to have true informed consent. Because when you have evidence-based research, evidence-based treatment kinds of phrases, that gives people the license not to tell you about all the other possible treatments that are out there, and it may stop you from being able to use your own culture and values in deciding what's right, because someone will have decided for you what is available. And it may stop a clinician who says, well, that doesn't make sense. Why would you be doing that with this child? From having any voice to say, well, that doesn't make sense. Best practices is another term that comes into play a lot, and it usually refers to panels of experts, and they're often self-appointed panels, usually having a particular clinical opinion. And best practices committees come out of the same problem, that we don't always know what's the best thing to do. So you convene a panel of recognized experts who seem to kind of know about this stuff, and they say what their opinion is, and they come up with a set of parameters of how we should do that. But often, there's no clear reference to a process of rational thinking, and there isn't this clarity of, okay, what does the research show, what might make sense, and then how do we give people the opportunity to make decisions that are best for them and their families. So why do we need evidence-based practice? Because our research is so far from perfect, because research often does not apply to real people, because we need to use clinical judgment in applying what we know, and because families must retain the right to informed choice in treatment. So I've got a little picture there for you. It's my picture of the night. The three core elements of evidence-based practice as they relate to informed consent. So if you see that, you've got these overlapping areas of relevant research, clinical judgment and experience, and family culture and values, all coming together at the very center to give you the opportunity to make true informed consent decisions. And there are so many therapies. I'm going to talk a bunch about therapies now. And I'm going to give them grades, because I am a teacher. And you may or may not agree with me, and I'll welcome plenty of back and forth about some of these things. You may say, Fader, I don't agree at all. My kid got a lot better. Whatever. But my confidence in the treatment, I'll give something an A. If there's lots of prospective data, meaning you decided you were going to study this, you studied it, it was clearly relevant to the situation, and there were no significant side effects. That's what gets an A. Are you going to guess right now, Nancy, how many things I gave an A to?
Very few.
Zero. We'll get there in the next slide. I give a B to treatments that have, or interventions that have lots of data, but not always relevant to every child, or the data is limited but supportive, but it seems relatively safe when it's done well, okay? Done well meaning carefully. I give a C to interventions that have pretty mixed data and maybe a reasonable theory, and not necessarily dangerous, but kind of iffy. And by the way, for all of these, you find people who've responded. So the issue isn't whether there are anecdotal episodes of people saying, you know, my kid got a lot better with this, even the ones with an F. But when I'm trying to give them a grade and try to think about my confidence in the treatment, this is where I go. D is no positive data and or not enough data and or an unclear theory and or unscreened anecdotal data and or safety concerns, but probably some people who've apparently clearly benefited. So that's kind of like the bottom of the barrel, except for F, which means the data says it doesn't work or there's significant evidence of danger. So I didn't give anybody an A. Nobody's met that criteria. And in fact, there's a great article that came out in this month, the May edition of Pediatrics, Journal of Pediatrics, that talks about how we just really don't have grade A, well, they didn't use this terminology, I do, but we don't have enough information to really know what's going to work with any individual child, and so you really do have to leave it in the hands of families to try to make their best decision based on the information that we have. So nobody gets an A. Well, a lot of people get Bs, and I'll start with behavioral training. I actually went mostly alphabetically, so, you know, call me a little perseverative. But I think it's a great place to start with behavioral training, particularly discrete trial training, because it's been with us for so long. I mean, Skinner lived a long time ago, taught us a lot about the ABCs, having an antecedent and a behavior and a consequence. And, you know, we really learn from behavioral theory that any surface behavior can be understood and can be changed by changing what happens before and changing what happens after. It is amazingly powerful. And of course, applied behavioral analysis, ABA, really put forward mostly by Ivar Lovaas of blessed memory, really has changed the lives of many, many, many people. You just can't say it hasn't. It is nicely data-driven. It shows you behaviors can be changed. So why do I give it a B? Well, I give it a B because a lot of times the way in which it's applied isn't relevant for children. So when I go into a classroom, for instance, and I see somebody who's getting really a very nicely laid out behavioral program, but for the past decade they've been learning how to sort silverware, I think, well, that's a misuse of ABA, of discrete trial, for instance, and that's not relevant. And the problem is that a lot of people will misuse and misapply this treatment. And it happens so often and so much that it's got to get a B. The other thing is there's an over-focus on compliance. It annoys the kids. You get a lot of them who are bucking it, or adults too. And I'll make a pitch later for the blending of engaging and compliance. When you see people do lovely, engaging, discrete trial like Lovaas did, actually, or like my colleague Alban Stamer does. I mean, she's just fabulous at it. You see kids who really, you know, I want to be that kid. You know the child's learning, and they're very engaged. But the problem is that the treatment itself doesn't really look at that internal emotional piece in quite the same way, I don't think, as maybe the developmental models might. And so because of that, you get a lot of people who aren't paying attention to it naturally, if they're not naturally inclined to do that with the child. And so it falls flat, and it feels more like you're commanding the child in a very robotic way, and then if the kid learns a robotic way of relating to the world, it's not necessarily adapted. We need this kind of training for certain kinds of learning. I want my firefighters to have this kind of training, to know how to approach a fire and get the hoses out and do it all lickety-split. Look at, we just had the military action in Pakistan, right? You don't think those guys weren't trained to do everything exactly right, to put their guns together when in the dark if they needed to? Absolutely, and it's this kind of training that's included in that. But there's more to it than that. So it's a B because you don't always use it. It's not always used the right way, and the over-focus on compliance tends to bend things in a way that doesn't always help our kids be as flexible and robust and able to relate as they might be. Oh, I keep hitting the wrong button. Next is cognitive behavioral therapy, and that's something that was developed in large part for things like adult depression and then obsessive compulsive disorder and lots of other anxiety disorders, things like that. It can be effective for the right person and if it's done well. And I mention it here because I have a lot of clients and patients, and there's a good literature on this, that that respond to this. Even if you're on the spectrum, you can respond to psychotherapy. But certainly a lot of people will say, psychotherapy is no good for kids with autism. They can't relate enough to make sense of it. I think that is rubbish. There's certainly some people who don't communicate in a manner that one would expect to do, you know, traditional psychoanalytic psychotherapy, something like that. But certainly cognitive behavioral therapy works, supportive therapies work, and in the developmental world, which we'll get to, those kinds of internal emotional principles are certainly at play. The problem with cognitive behavioral therapy, and one of the reasons it gets a B, is that sometimes it's executed without attention to the surround. So, for instance, a lot of times, a lot of our kids, particularly we call them high-functioning, maybe the Asperger crowd, are very talkative and very intellectualizing, and so they seem very logical. And so you're trying to do cognitive behavioral therapy with them, but it's a very repetitive type process, and they are very, very stuck. And in fact, the OCD type symptoms are very, very hard to treat in our people with autism spectrum disorders, much more hard to treat than people who don't have that autism spectrum quality. Regular obsessive compulsive disorder is actually very treatable by comparison. So there's kind of a difference, maybe biologically even. I don't think anybody knows for sure. So the thing about cognitive behavioral therapy is that it's got its limits and that it's often applied to people who seem to be very verbal but don't necessarily participate in reciprocal interactions. And so going verbal with an overly verbal person ends up being a mistake. DIR floor time, well, this is where I live. This is my favorite. You can see my little ICDL symbol in the lower right-hand corner. For me, I think it makes sense. I think it works great. I'm going to actually spend a couple slides on it because I have a captive audience. I think it has great new prospective research coming out of York University and coming out of University of Michigan, so stay tuned. That is a mistake on the slide for CircleStretch. It should say CircleStretch.com. We're no longer on Blogspot. And ICDL.com has more information about it. But just to give you a quick overview, DIR, Developmental Individual Differences Relationship-Based Intervention, is really the heir to the biopsychosocial approach. And that's an approach that came up in the 70s and 80s in healthcare that talked about people in a very holistic way. It's not just the pills. It's how people feel and their families and their society. All that combines to make for whatever's happening with somebody. And so, for example, somebody having a heart attack, you think now about their stress level. You think about depression, not just what's happening in their coronary arteries. You think about whether they're going through some stressful life changes with the economy or whatever. Or maybe bring it for more of our kids. You have somebody who's not sleeping. I got to tell you, Southern California, we have a Santa Ana. I've had more emergency calls in the past couple of days than in months. So, you know, this is an environmental thing. And if I wasn't thinking in a more biopsychosocial approach, thinking about the entire picture from electrons to the universe and everything in between, getting to the person's emotions, the person's family, the person's response to hot weather, their hydration, I wouldn't have thought of, oh, it's Santa Ana. Well, actually, around here, everybody thinks it's a Santa Ana. But I think you get what I mean. There's a lot of things that can make something happen. Well, the DIR approach is very much akin to a biopsychosocial approach, and it developed actually with fussy babies, but developed into a kind of approach that is very applicable to our kids. So we'll talk just a little bit more about it. Developmental speaks to a number of different things, but one of the most important pieces is that it recognizes that emotion is really the glue that kind of holds together our cognition and learning and our ability to handle, regulate ourselves and handle sensory information, things like that. I talk about the impact of postpartum depression on infants. That's just thinking about the relationship a little bit there. I'm going to set that aside for a second. But think about emotion as the most kind of important thing, kind of gluing everything together. Think about it this way. If you ever tried to go on a long bike ride or climb up a hill, and you did it while talking with somebody, and you're kind of relating with them and thinking about, that probably made the whole thing go a whole lot better, that emotional connection to somebody else. Or even just the emotional drive to do things makes people pull things together and able to solve their problems or social problems. There are a number of stages of social-emotional development. I'm not going to go into them in detail, but I'll give you a very oversimplified rubric for it in a minute. But the idea is that the key to relating and learning is to use the emotional connection with people to be able to regulate yourself better, be more connected with other people, and then engage in a flow of interactions with other people that's ever more complex. But to be able to do that, there are a number of areas of individual differences that you have to take into account. Sensory, and we talked a little bit about this earlier, motor tone and planning, receptive communication and expressive communication, especially that nonverbal back-and-forth cueing that happens from infancy that a lot of our kids and adults have trouble with, and so we have to be a little bit less verbal with them sometimes and kind of get into their line of sight and get them up and moving rather than down and hunched over a toy or something. Visual spatial function is important. A lot of our family members have challenges in those areas, and it takes up so much of our usual brain power that we have to take a lot of that into consideration. And then how do we actually act on the world? Connie Lillis and Janice Turnbull put out a great book that talks about this in a lot of detail. But the idea that executive function is how you take your ability to regulate the sensory information you're getting and that it makes, that it's meaningful to you, relevance, and then what do you do to do something about all that to act on the world to move yourself forward? Well, you've got to have an idea and then a plan and then a sequence of steps to the plan and then execute the plan, and then always you have to adapt because nothing ever happens the way you expected. DIR is relationship-based and relies on our ability to co-regulate with our family members to try to help them stay steady based in our connection with them, that engagement, that emotional connection, and then get a flow of interaction going. My circle stretch cards are that kind of oversimplified stages of social-emotional, functional-emotional development, helping the child or person be calm enough to interact, truly connected to others, whether that's you or maybe peers or somebody else, maybe students, student and teacher, and then get that continuous, expanding, balanced, back-and-forth flow of interactions. So I wanted to just give a long commercial, a long infomercial about what DIR floor time is and then talk a little bit more about it. It organizes your entire intervention. So you can think about those individual differences as the roots to a tree, those functional, emotional, developmental levels, that ability to regulate, engage, and have this flow of interaction as the trunk of the tree. And then the other things that you learn, whether it's through ABA or something else, the specific skills at the branches and leaves of the tree. So if you think about that picture and Greenspan's book before he passed a year ago called The Learning Tree with his wife, Nancy Thorndike Greenspan, explains that really nicely. I've got it at the end of the talk as well. So that's the DIR model. That's why I like it. Actually, there's a lot of great research coming out on it, plenty of supportive research, and I think it's well worthy of your consideration as a framework because it kind of includes under its umbrella all the other interventions. So it's very helpful. It includes ABA, for instance. It includes, if necessary, use of medications to help with regulation. Well, coming up next is inclusion. So that's the idea of being in a regular class, no matter how challenged a person is. And I got to tell you, for me, it's associated with the best outcomes in my career. So I've seen people do best when you're able to do successful inclusion. Well, why does it get a B? It's very hard to do right. There's a lot of great social modeling. There's a lot of win-win when done correctly for all the students, certainly the student who has challenges, but also the student surrounding. But safety can be a big concern if someone's running off. You have to figure out how to deal with that. And support to the staff is actually pretty rare, but it's so critical to make that work well. Inclusion gets a B, a robust B, when it's done well, and boy, can it just fragment on you when it's not done well. Medication for symptoms of autism spectrum disorder. The research is mixed. As I said, there are two approved medications, Abilify and Risperdal, for irritability with autism. There's a lot of off-label use, but that's the nature of the medical field. I mean, if you have a medication and you're a doctor, you're allowed to use it for whatever you want. You should have a good reason for doing that. And medication can help a good plan work well. I mean, that's the bottom line. Not always, but a lot of times if you have a good enough plan and it's not quite right, maybe there's a little bit of inattention that you can make a little bit better, a little bit of mood instability that you can make a little bit better, and that can kind of make the whole thing click. Absolutely. You have to watch for side effects, things like that. But here's the thing. Medication doesn't make up for a bad plan. And there are a lot of bad plans. And just medication is a bad plan. It takes thoughtful trials of medication within the context of thinking about everything else that's going on to make it work. And CircleStretch.com, oh, there I got it right, has one of my medication talks, and Moms Fighting Autism probably has it. I'm sure you guys have it archived. Yes, Nancy? You have it archived.
Yeah, I'm sure we do.
I give it a B for lack of reliable efficacy and for all the side effects. PEX, a lot of us use PEX, very helpful addition to communication. Kids are less frustrated when they can ask for things. The reason I give it a B is that it tends to pull for manding versus expressive communication. And it lends to reduced expectations of the child sometimes, too. Let's see your PECs. You know, it ends up being all about the PECs, maybe asking for things to relieve frustration rather than talking about the world. You know, some people can use those systems, including the more electronic ones, in a way that talks more about the world, but unfortunately, much like with discrete trial training, things tend to degenerate to a lower common denominator. That happens pretty often with PECs, so you got to be careful. Pivotal response training is a more democratic and naturalistic version of some of the behavioral interventions. So, for instance, instead of saying point to green, you might say, do you want the green one or the red one? It really gives the child an opportunity to participate in an intervention. And for a lot of kids and a lot of families, it's got just the right balance of structure and freedom that really helps kids move forward. And it's really those kinds of principles are embedded in most of the good mixed behavioral developmental kinds of interventions I'm going to talk about as well. I think relevance is still an issue at times because sometimes people have goals for sessions that aren't really where the child is. And again, it gets misplaced. Again, great clinicians always recognize that, and they shift to what makes sense to the child and maybe to the family. So anything in the hands of a great clinician can work well. But again, the everyday pivotal response training often looks like, okay, today the child is going to do this, but the child might not be on that same page. It does allow for some initiative, which I really like, but it is somewhat limited. There's lots and lots of research about it. Again, it gets a B because it's often used in a way that isn't necessarily relevant to the child's needs. Mixed developmental behavioral approaches, very, very exciting. The Early Start Denver model, Project Impact, the Bridge project that I'm working on at UCSD, have early encouraging studies or pilot studies. And the hope here is that you get the best of both worlds, the developmental that I was talking about with DIR floor time, as well as the behavioral piece when you need it, moving in between from one to the other as appropriate for the child. They're mostly parent-driven, meaning we train parents to carry these things out, which does put a burden on parents to some degree, and you have to be careful and give parents a lot of support to be able to do it well. But it's you know, clearly a more efficient way to get treatment delivery and intervention, and you know, I think it's really the future, really the post-denominational future, I like to call it. A lot of these tend to be more goal-driven than development-driven, so when you're talking about more of a free environment where you're looking at engagement and reciprocity and building complexity of ideas, that's wonderful, and then getting some specific skills later, that's great, but I think a lot of the people who carry these out are people who've been trained so well in the more structured behavioral approaches that they haven't quite gotten the hang of the more free-flowing piece. But it's the free-flowing piece that should be the goal in the end. So that's where I think some of the hang-up is. So when I see videotapes of it, I'm a little bit discouraged sometimes. So I give it a B because, or these as a group, a B because they're early in development. and they need better attention to the. They also need better attention to reflective process, the individual differences, and the child centering, which is what I mean by the more free flowing interaction. A lot of them don't even speak to individual differences. Bridge does, probably because me and some of my colleagues are really felt that that was important, and the community decided that that was important. And reflective process is another really important piece. That gets me back to that bottom line. Remember earlier I was saying that I were alluding to the idea that you have to, in informed consent, have a process that's ongoing and be thinking about things and do them thoughtfully and come back to it. Reflective process is about having opportunities to look at what you're doing, think about it, and then go back into the fray and do it better at several levels. So support to a parent who's not with the child in the moment to think about it. Support to the therapist from a supervisor or tutor to help the parent. I mean, it happens in a parallel process at several levels, because really what you want in the end with these is the parent supporting the child to develop better in terms of their ability to relate and communicate and to do the things that they need to do. Occupational therapy gets another robust B. Again, people tend to argue about what the research is like. There's actually an article that came out in January of this year from the Journal of the American Society of Occupational Therapists, I think that's what it was, that starts to speak to the use of sensory integration occupational therapy in people with autism. So we're getting more research there. It's clear that fine motor skills are a critically important area, and it's not just handwriting. It's being able to do what you need to do in the world. Can you blow bubbles? Can you control the speeds on your bike? Can you do all kinds of things that are just important for, I mean, look, we're people who rely on our vision and our hands. Gross motor skills, again, if you're going to play all the other games that the other reindeer play, you really do have to pay attention to gross motor skills. So physical therapy and occupational therapists often can help with this, as well as adaptive physical therapy. Sensory integration, another critical area. So again, hyper and hyposensitivities are the rule more than the exception with our kids, and so we have to be able to think about what can we do about that to keep people from being overwhelmed by sensory information and or more able to tolerate it. The reason why it gets a B is that we're looking for more research, and frequently there's this top-down delivery. You're going to learn this new skill, as opposed to kind of joining the child and learning with the child and helping the child kind of come up, bring their radar up, and be able to do things more and tolerate their environment more. Plenty of times it's just delivered in a way that's more directive, and then there's not a lot of buy-in, really. The other thing is that sensory breaks often turn into escape behavior. So I'm having trouble, I'm going to take a sensory break. And so people often learn to take sensory breaks instead of gradually learning to tolerate their environment better. But of course, the very best of our occupational therapists and physical therapists, consulting with our teachers and us, will help us figure out how to engage with a child while paying attention to sensory problems and helping within that relationship, just like we can climb the hill better or ride the bike better, you know, when we're with somebody and engaged with them, help us and help our kids be more able to tolerate and respond to sensory environments. So so gets a B, gets a solid B from me. One-on-one aid, paraprofessionals, they can be really very good. I mean, good engaging people who support development and facilitate interactions are the rare gems and can really be the key reason why a child improves, particularly at school. There is this issue of over-dependence on aides who will be prompting, so we'll talk about fading prompts, versus the Ann Sullivans of history, right, who helped, who can help people really do anything. You know, Ann Sullivan famously helped Helen Keller learn to communicate and become who she was. There are a lot of C's, D's, and F's in the paraprofessional world, and part of that is because a lot of places will rotate aides. They say to avoid people becoming dependent, but of course, you and I know that if our typical, neurotypical child had a new teacher every 3 months, we would be at the door of the principal's office, camped out, demanding that they get a, you know, regular person there, because it's all about relationships. So rotating aides to avoid dependence is, you know, problematic. Poor communication or management in the team is often a problem, so lots of times aides aren't allowed to talk to parents, and they're managed by teachers who have enough on their plate, and they might not have the management skills. It's a big problem, so it's hard to get this spinning in a good direction. When it does, it's great. When it doesn't, well, it's a problem. RDI, Relationship Development Intervention, not to be confused with DIR, is lovely at setting up social problems to solve in thinking, relating, and communicating. The research is supported but not direct yet, as far as I can see, and it has a lot to say about thinking about thought, making explicit what we don't usually think about. So particularly with a higher functioning kid, might help someone think about what somebody else is thinking, not unlike some of Michelle Garcia Winner's work, which I'm not sure I put that in this talk, which gets another solid B. We're awaiting more research for that. It has a little bit more of a what's the goal for the day kind of feel to it sometimes, but actually I've got close colleagues who, again, execute it really well and smoothly, and they adjust to the needs of their clients. It's not as broad as DIR in the sense that you're not thinking about all these individual differences, and the reflective piece, I don't think, is quite set up the same. But certainly is one of our companion developmental interventions that is worthy of thought. CERT, Social Communication, Emotional Regulation, and Transactional Support, is really a speech therapy. Barry Crozant and others, I think Amy Wedderby, have come up with that. And it does all these things. It addresses social communication, emotional regulation, and transactional support. They have a little bit less attention to family dynamics than some of the other developmental approaches, but I consider this a developmentally keyed communication intervention. And has a little bit less attention to individual differences. But again, great ideas, really lovely work, great research showing improvements in social communication and use of language and emotional regulation. Social Stories, that's Carol Gray, the teacher who taught us that usually we do X, but sometimes Y happens instead. That's okay. Incredibly powerful approach, really, and there's some nice studies on it. It's usually a small but very useful piece of the bigger pie. There's actually a great Talmudic-inspired schema that covers about every social story I ever heard. And the saying is that, it's not exactly this, but when it's great when things happen the way we expect it. The implication is that nothing ever happens the way we expect it. So the rule of life is that nothing ever happens the way we expect it. So what you need to do is to think about how it didn't happen the way you expected, step back, and figure out what you're going to do about it. So for all our kids who have an expectation, whether they're verbal or not verbal, about how something is going to play out, and you know this and I know this, that plenty of times when they've done one thing, they want to do it the same way every time, right? Am I right? Mm-hmm. So when this happens and their expectations aren't met, they often have, you know, a terrible experience and have an emotional meltdown and a tantrum or this or that. Very, very problematic. Well, if our attitude, and if we remember that everything we do isn't going to come out the way we expected. My talk tonight is not coming out the way I expected. It's hot in my room. I have my AC off for sound quality. We got a Santa Ana. I'm not happy about it. I got the honey in my tea because it's a little sore from talking. But, you know, I'm adjusting. I got the honey to adjust for my throat. I got, you know, you're not seeing me, but I'm wearing a T-shirt. So again, nothing happens the way you expect. You got to figure out how to adjust. So that's very, it's a very hard lesson for our kids to learn. You can say, gee, you know, that's a great idea, Johnny. Maybe we will go to the library today. We'll see if we can make that work out. Not sure, but we'll see. You know, everything's like a not sure, but we'll see. And that's hard to accept for someone who wants very clear, firm ideas and, you know, feels like it's very wrong if things don't happen according to the schedule. But nothing happens according to the schedule. You go to the park is always different. Every time you go, it's a slightly different time of day, a slightly different time of season, slightly different weather conditions. Everything's a little different. And one of our problems, I think, sometimes is that we think of our kids as needing structure and support in knowing what to expect. so that they're not as upset. And that's true to a degree. I mean, certainly even for my job, if I come in and I don't know who I'm seeing today, and it's whoever walks in, I'm going to do whatever they need, I mean, that's a problem, and I can't tolerate that. I don't think anybody could. On the other hand, if I have to be so narrow as not to be flexible enough to know when a certain person comes in, what I might be thinking they might need and what they might be thinking they might need are different, well, then I'm going to be in trouble. So you have to find that balance by accepting that, yeah, we're going to have this plan, but it's a plan, and plans never come out exactly as you expected. And we just got to see how it's going to be and what we're going to do. Very powerful stuff, Carol. I thank you. And, again, very potent. It's just not, the whole answer. Gets a B. Special day classes? Oh, that's interesting. You know, contrast that with inclusion. In San Diego, special day classes may no longer exist in parts of our district. That's a class that's, you know, it's a separate class for people who have specific difficulties. Sometimes they're confined to people with autism spectrum disorder. Sometimes they're more mixed. Well, here's the thing. Lots of times they're limiting socially. Lots of times there are lower expectations for our kids. There may be more staff to students, and they may be more savvy and tolerant, which could be great. And sometimes kids do really, really nicely when you put them in a place where it works for them, as opposed to expecting them to do well in inclusion when you don't have adequate support and everybody is frustrated. So gets a B, but again, has to be done well. There's some pretty bad classes out there and some pretty great classes out there. And as you probably know, everything relies on the teacher and the staff and the support that they get. Speech and language therapy, this just goes on, doesn't it? So what can you say? This is a vital service. It requires talented practitioners. These attempts to teach language, look, I have a misspell there, attempts to teach language behaviorally are, in my opinion, misguided. So there are a lot of people who say, we don't need speech and language therapists anymore. We can use the ABCs of behavior therapy to teach people to talk. And I think that doesn't teach people to use language. It teaches them to say certain words, maybe in certain circumstances, but it'll never give you the richness of communication. So this drill or kill, top-down kind of speech therapy or the behavioral stuff gets either a C, D, or F, depending on how bad it is. And the other thing to remember is that communication before we ever develop speech and beyond the use of speech is what's critically important. That nonverbal cueing and engaging and flow is really the thing. So when you're shopping for speech therapy, look for somebody who is paying attention to the nonverbal cues. So a great example, again, with our high-functioning kids, somebody who's just talking at you, they're with a speech therapist, they say, oh, child talks really well, doesn't mean speech therapy. But the musicality isn't there, the voice, the prosody, maybe they're talking very loud or in a very monotonic way, or not giving people a chance to really converse. And lots of times we have tests for this. We have pragmatic language tests that even our schools will give, but those are often pencil and paper tests about, you know, what do you do in this or that situation, which some of our kids can answer pretty well. But then you get them out on the playground, and they're not doing well. And why aren't they doing well? Well, because maybe they're using just kind of scripted speech. Or maybe they're not processing very well, so they're trying to control the conversation. Or they just can't keep up, and so they wander off and pace. You know? So these kinds of things happen all the time. With the nonverbal piece, we need to learn to be more quiet and not be so worried about how many words someone has, and more thinking about what I wrote at the bottom of the slide, the repair of broken communication. That might be the single most important concept in all of treatment. If you want somebody to initiate and get better at thinking, relating, and communicating, well, what do you want from them? You want, in any particular situation, for them to contribute. Well, in the most minute piece of contribution to an interaction, if we are able to set things up so someone is reasonably regulated and they're wanting to be engaged with us, and we give them an opening and an opportunity to wait, and then they repair the communication by saying something, doing something, making some sort of gesture that recognizes that they want to contribute. They're recognizing that they're different from us, that we're not doing everything for them or telling them what to do, and they're also recognizing that we're here and not that they're just doing something out to the in the environment. It's a very important thing to think about. Think about the repair of communication as the central idea in all communication. And by the way, communication doesn't happen that way most of the time. About a third of the time, communication is lost. If you listen to me and my wife talk, a third of what she says, a third of what I say, most human communication lost to the abyss, never comes back. Whatever it was, it's not there anymore. And that's just how that is. A third of communication in typical communication might be pretty good, kind of going back and forth, and it's a decent flow. But it's that middle third, the third where there's a break and then a repair, where you've got people learning to and becoming confident in their own competence, even non-verbally, even as babies and growing up, to be able to participate in an interaction with somebody. And every interaction is different. There's a whole universe of interactions and shades of emotion. That's what we're looking for. That is really what you're looking for in pretty much all your therapies. Social skills group, well, there's some universality there, right? Being with others with similar challenges is often very, very comforting for people. I've got a colleague up the street, Dr. Cynthia Norell, who's written a book about her friends clubs that really kind of demonstrates how people just feel comfortable when they're with other people who have, you know, kind of similar kinds of things going on. It's just great that you can't say enough for finding your own tribe in a way. Getting out in the community and doing things is, of course, one of the most functional things that can be done. The fact that California has cut out a lot of funding for that sort of thing is such a shame, because when you're trying to get people out and functional in the world, that's the kind of thing that makes it possible. There are safety issues that are problematic and that, you know, we have to deal with those, like if someone tends to run, figuring out where they're going to run, giving them directionality, things like that, having an engaged relationship with them so that they're running with us, not away from us. It can often be didactic in a way that might try to teach people skills, but they don't always translate. You have to be careful. And then research? What research? Oh, my goodness. There's a great piece in magazine, I'm trying to remember the name of it, for the Autism Society of America. It came out about a year ago, and it was by, she's the Queen of Card. What is her name? And she helped start Act Today for Military Families, which is a marvelous organization. Now, I'm not going to remember your name, and I apologize, but it will come back to me later. Anyway, she did a piece.
I got it. Doreen Grant.
Oh, yeah, Dr. Green Grampache. So she's, you know, very expert in ABA, discrete trial training, and helps run founded CARD, and as I said, Act Today for Military Families, which has been a very marvelous organization. Well, anyway, Doreen wrote a piece in the Autism Advocate, I think is the name of it, talking about, kind of lamenting, that because our kids are all so different, it's hard to do good research on social skills training. Well, a lot of people who are, you know, kind of cost control people will say, well, there's no research, we're not going to do it. But you know what? I think there's a lot of good anecdotal research that social skills kinds of interventions are critically helpful, and so often that despite the difficulties doing good research on this topic, I got to give it a B. It's just too important to leave it aside or not fund it. So it's one of those areas where clinical judgment has to come into play and say, okay, well, we may not have the research yet, but we need to be doing this. It just makes sense. Supportive psychotherapy, I mentioned therapy earlier. Many people on the spectrum really do respond to empathy and understanding. Who knew, right? Many people spend time sitting and being understanding without really helping clients. And that's why it kind of gets a B. That happens in regular psychotherapy. If you've been to therapy, sometimes if you're just sitting there and you're sort of going over the same material and it's not really going anywhere, that's a problem. And it's also hard to do. With people who have trouble relating and communicating, it's hard to do psychotherapy. It's hard to find good therapists. But get the B because there are plenty of people who really do respond. I wish we had better research on it. We don't. Teach, treatment, and education of autistic communication handicapped children. I think I got that backwards. It has some nice structured teaching. It really works for learning tasks and routines. There is great research behind it. Uses all those visual models and schedules we're all using. And if you don't have those kinds of principles in consideration for your child's educational program, you need to take a look at it. There is this issue of having very comforting routines versus failure to develop flexibility and initiative, so you can get kind of stuck in some of the routines. But again, the very best people instituting these programs out of North Carolina, might be South Carolina, are really adept at trying to make people flexible as well. Well, what can you say? Great teachers, great clinicians tend to do good things with whatever theory they're working with. Oh, we're getting to the sea level stuff, right? I'm trying to see how many oops slides we have left. There we go. Not sure. So auditory integration training gets a C. Well, why is that? It's the rule of thirds. Auditory integration training runs on the theory of the musical ear. A lot of our kids have trouble with auditory processing, and there are a whole bunch of therapies that have come up with the idea that if you expose people, usually using headphones, to certain kinds of filtered information, usually musical information, mom's voice, stuff like that, but filtered in a way so that tones that you're hypersensitive to, they'll give you louder so that you don't listen to them as much anymore, your ear gets used to it, and tones that you have trouble hearing that you're hyposensitive to, they may kind of dim, but your ear wants to hear them because it's Mozart or mom's voice. And so when you listen to it and you don't have auditory problems like some of our kids, it's really maddening. And in fact, for some of our kids, I think it's sort of maddening. But at the same time, the idea is that at the other end, if you do this in the right way, you end up with smoothing out your audiograms so that you don't have all these mixed hyper and hyposensitivities to tones, and you're hearing things more like a musician would. The musical ear is sort of the idea here. Fast forward, I mentioned earlier, is a proprietary form of this that's done with a one-on-one trainer in front of a computer. Aerobics is almost like a stripped-down version of Fast Forward, which requires no training and costs maybe, what, $50 now? You can get the CD, although the research is missing. The listening program is another kind of version similar to this, but it's very passive, kind of listening to general music, nice classical music usually, very calming, with the idea that things might get better, but it's not geared to the specific child's audiogram. Why do I give it a C? Again, because of research issues. It's very, very mixed and controversial research. The other thing is the rule of thirds, meaning in my experience and the experience of a lot of people, a third of people seem to really feel like they've gotten benefit. A third of people feel like it didn't do anything, and a third of people feel like they were actually, feel worse afterwards. And a lot of people, Terry Silverman's a real proponent of Berard and comes to San Diego every once in a while. She would say that if you're having a no response or a negative response, it probably means you need more treatment. So you have to decide, okay, well, should we do more or not? So again, you have to kind of think about whether you want it. I've certainly met people who really, really feel that it made a difference. I'd really, really love to see more and better research on it and to figure out who responds and who doesn't. Dietary interventions. Well, a lot of us have our kids on gluten-free, casein-free diets. We now recognize, just like with autism, we recognize more like 1 in 100 or so people probably have autism spectrum disorder. Probably 1 in 100 people also have a sensitivity to gluten. And you can get a lab test called a tissue transglutaminase test that kind of is a screen for that. So many of us probably would do better on a gluten-free diet, maybe on casein-free as well. There's that theory of too many internal endogenous opiates, so kind of a leaky gut thing where by taking in some of these things, they get through into your bloodstream more easily than they should. They get turned into opiate-like substances more easily, and they kind of make it more difficult for someone with autism to be related and communicating and all those kinds of things. So that's the theory, and there are labs that will find these problems in your bloodstream or urine. I think whether or not you actually have problems, clinical problems. And so, I think the, it's a little bit mushy in terms of good research, I think. But there are people who clearly respond, and there are a lot of people who've got this gluten allergy and they've got malabsorption. The Feingold diet is basically taking salicylates out of your diet, which is the stuff that's in aspirin. And some people really get amped up on aspirin. So it makes sense to maybe try a salicylate-free diet for some people. You can look it up on the Internet, for instance, staying away from purple grapes, but maybe you can have green grapes, that sort of thing. So that's lovely. Whether people respond or not, again, research, not so sure. But for, for these diets, these first two diets, they're mostly harmless as long as you're getting good nutrition, probably get a good nutritional consult. And there are lots of books out about them, how to do this, and do it in a way that's, less hard on the family, although it can be hard on family sometimes. if you break the diet and then you feel like everything is lost and you've lost all this time, or you know, somebody gives your child the red apple that wrecks the diet and you've been working so hard to keep the child soy-free, it can be pretty maddening. So there are issues. The ketogenic diet is a really interesting one. That's one where it's kind of like a high fat, high protein diets that a lot of people have used to lose weight rapidly. It's the same kind of thing. You end up your body ends up acting as if it's starving and puts out ketones. It's really burning up fats, and that may or may not actually be good for you if you're trying to lose weight. But if you have a seizure disorder, as it turns out, there is some reasonable anecdotal evidence that people with intractable seizures can do better with a ketogenic diet. So this is not just for any old person with autism and really should be done with medical supervision. But a ketogenic diet, if you've got trouble with seizures that won't go away, is probably worthy of your consideration. Let me put it to you this way. If I had a child with seizures that just weren't going away and I'd been trying all kinds of medicine, I would be considering whether a ketogenic diet might be helpful. And some of these anecdotes are that the seizures went away and they stopped the diet and they didn't come back. So, yeah, again, hard to know. Dogs and dolphins get a C. Dogs and dolphins are great, right? They're engaging. It's a memorable experience. I've had kids who've learned to fetch because of the dog. The research is very anecdotal. Dolphins are very expensive. Dogs are expensive over time. Untraining your therapy dog is very common. We've got a lot of kids around here who get these therapy dogs to help them with socialization. Then they untrain them and they become family pets. So I'm not sure about, you know, whether that really helps. And there are often very unrealistic expectations of socialization. So people say, look, I'm going to get my kid a dog. The dog will be very social, and then other people want to pet the dog, and they'll be able to talk about the dog, and my child will make friends and get a lot better. And I think that is often true to a very, very small extent, but it sure isn't a cure-all. I think dogs and pets can often be very, very helpful, but it is a big family commitment, and you have to be very judicious in how you use pets and animals. That said, a lot of our kids really do respond to animals and are good to them, and we can talk about them. And if we're using them kind of as a focus of interaction and engagement and warmth and caring and all those kinds of things, it can be marvelous. But that's like with anything, right? If you've got it and you're good at doing it and do it well, it works well. But lots of times just saying, oh, get a dog, not a good idea for a lot of families. Hyperbaric oxygen. I'll tell you why I give it a C. There's some recent research that really said, not so helpful. Now, if you go to the conferences, the Autism One conference was a great one last year, where you've got a lot of these hyperbaric chambers set up. You can get your home chamber. And the amount of extra oxygen and pressure that they're putting on you is the same as being at the bottom of a swimming pool, as opposed to true hyperbaric therapy, which is more like being under, you know, several hundred feet of water. There's a real difference. So what you're buying isn't necessarily as impressive as what you'd be getting if you went to a dive chamber. The theory is that if you add more oxygen to your bloodstream, it gets to your brain, makes the cells work better, you think better. And I know plenty of people who really, really say that it really, really helps them. You know, what can I say? We didn't talk a lot about placebo effect today, but half the time, whatever you do works. And it works for, you know, discrete periods of time, usually a few weeks at a time, and then you can do it again and maybe it will work again. A lot of times it's because we believe in it. That's called a placebo effect. And that's why medications are typically tested against a placebo, because if you can do as well as placebo, well, that's great, but why would you do the medicine if you can do a fake pill that doesn't have side effects? So there may be some placebo effect, but look, if you can do it safely and you want to pay the money and you want to do hyperbarics, you know, who am I to stop you? It's safe if it's done right. And there you are. Music therapy, lovely. Interesting theories, interesting procedures. I don't think the research is clearly vetted. I recently got a bunch of research. My assistant, Mara, who I think is listening tonight, gave me a bunch of research from a local music therapist that we're kind of sorting through to see, okay, does this really fit with, is the research good, robust research, and does it fit with what we're trying to get at with our kids? I think music is very engaging for many people. not for everybody. It's the kind of thing you wouldn't want to push on somebody who doesn't want it, and you probably would want to use as a vehicle for someone who's really interested in it. It gets a C because it's just not very robust in terms of research. It feels a little bit fluffy. But that said, there are going to be specific kids who all go to the school, all go to the IEP, and all say, you know, this kid needs music therapy with someone who's good at doing it with kids with the autism spectrum disorder, and this kid needs it because this kid is a musical kid. And so you need to use, you got to play to their strengths and then work from there. So that's kind of where I am with that. Vision therapy, very interesting. I think people probably do see very differently. I think from person to person, we all see a little bit differently. And maybe there is some change with eye exercises in prisons. Again, I got to kind of come back to that rule of thirds, much like with auditory integration therapy, one-third better, one-third unchanged, one-third feel like it's worse. The research there is also hotly disputed. Vitamins, nutritional supplements, we could probably spend all day on this. There are a lot of our kids, a lot of our family members who don't eat very well. There are, like, oodles of theories we don't have time to go through. There are a lot of articles in non-medical journals. They don't tend to reach the level of the better medical journals. There are a lot of testimonials, and there are a lot of sales. The problem is there are too many charlatans. I think there are some Bs out there, some things that are really robust. I think the recent research on vitamin D is useful, but you have to be careful not to use too much vitamin D. I think more than 1,000 units a week is probably too much. Some people will say, take 5,000 a day. I don't think that's good for you. So, you know, some things like that. And then there are some very disreputable people out there selling things that I think are really problematic. So it averages a C because there's some B's and D's. Yeast eradication therapy. The theory is that a lot of us have too much yeast, and there are labs that always find it. There are lots of anecdotal reports of improvement, but I think that we have to think about placebo effect. But the approach is benign. Usually people give, you know, diflucan or nystatin. Nystatin is absolutely benign stuff. It stays in your gut, just kills yeast. Might change how your bowel movements are because it's changing the flora and fauna of your gut. But, yeah, otherwise, if you want to pay for it, you want to give it a try, nystatin is cheap. Why not? But I'm not sure that there's any real research that truly supports it in a way that would be acceptable to me, Fader. Let's get to the D's. Oral chelation. Wonderful anecdotes. Many families are really certain it's helped. Why a D? Because it's hard to do it safely. Those medicines that are used for it are hepatotoxic. They can kill your liver. You have to be very, very careful. And the theory keeps getting disproved. When people try to do actual research on it, they find it doesn't work. Didn't make a difference. Rapid prompting, well, here's the problem. I think it might rise to a B when research issues are sorted out. I agree that there are some people who are trapped inside bodies that won't work for them. I agree that there are some people who are doing all the typing for the nonverbal people. So I think there are people who probably unconsciously do that, and it ends up being, a mistake. But I think there are probably people who are really using it, too. But it's hard to separate out those people. There are incredible stories. Another issue is that it's often proprietary, so people are saying, yeah, do this, it'll work for your kid. So that's another issue. So don't be shocked if that one rises to a B as we understand this more and more. My colleague Ricky Robinson, who did a talk last night for Autism College, has had a whole lot of people who have responded to different kinds of communication techniques. Chantal Cecile-Kira, also very respected, knows of plenty of people who really seem to have responded. But it's not for everybody. If you're just doing that in a way that ends up being, you know, difficult to show that what is there is really real, then you may be, you know, kind of going down some blind alleys, which can sometimes be hurtful if there are accusations of abuse or, you know, some of those other things that have come up. Secretin. Doesn't work, has mild side effects, the clinics were expensive, and a lot of people made it an oral treatment, which means that it broke down in your stomach and it never even got to you. So, you know, it's probably placebo effects for anybody who did any better with that. Marijuana, oh, here's an F. So marijuana, there have been a bunch of reports on the internet. The reason why I'm mentioning this is I was recently asked to do a talk, a review article for the California Pharmacists Association. So they've got their magazine, and another colleague and I wrote this long article about medications and some of the alternative things. And everybody kept asking about, well, what about marijuana? Because of reports on the internet that marijuana is making some kids with autism feel better. Please do not use this stuff with your child. It kills memory cells. It kills them. Some of our kids, their best strength is their memory, and it kills the cells. It inhibits initiation and motivation, and it predisposes to psychosis. Obviously, the smoke is extremely carcinogenic, but I'm presuming that a lot of people would use a more purified THC. All that said, it's just, I don't think it's going to be good for your kid, and I can't recommend it. There are other ways to mellow out. We can talk about medicines yet again another day, or you can go to my circlestretch.com or listen to the last talk, but please stay clear of marijuana. Therapeutic holding, there's another one that's sort of old and bad. It had some similarities to good sensory OT where you're kind of doing some deep pressure, things like that, and once had a very respectable following among very reputable people, but it's so often misused and there were so many deaths associated with it that it just can't be recommended. You're generally putting ideas and information out into the public in a way that they are likely to lead to injury and death, so I can't possibly recommend it. IV chelation, it's dangerous. The theory keeps getting disproved. We have that one death that you may be aware of. Not a good idea. So the bottom line is to create an ongoing process to keep the team focused on engagement. So engagement will organize the intervention, that whole repair becoming that golden moment. That'll pull for individualized understanding of our kids to make whatever it is happen more, which will lead to developmental progress ever more complex at whatever level our kids and family members are. And in that kind of a framework, all the therapies become coherent subparts of the plan. And then it's critically important to meet regularly as a team and in different ways and different combinations as needed to problem solve and keep your plan rich and alive and growing and changing as needed. So that way to organize it that I mentioned earlier, it's this tree is really so helpful. I'm so grateful to Stan Greenspan. You know, Greenspan and Lovaas both died over the past, a little bit over a year ago. We lost two giants in the field, and Lovaas, of course, left us ABA. Greenspan left us a lot, but one of the things he really left us here was this tree. So try to keep that in mind. So some resources, certainly you can go to icbl.com, circlestretch.com, and The Learning Tree by Stanley and Nancy Thorndike Greenspan. So that's the end of my slides. I'm happy to go to some of these questions. Nancy, do you want to help me with
yes.
that? Are there a bunch
yeah.
of
Yeah, I actually had a couple questions, too.
Okay.
With so many therapies and treatments out there now, how do families know where to begin to decide what's right for their child, which direction to go?
Well, isn't that the million-dollar question, right?
It is. Can you answer
it? Even talking about a diagnosis, most families, the first response, certainly my family, was to put our heads in the sand. Oh, there's nothing wrong with my kid. But then, after that, and you start kind of working through that there's really a problem and the sadness and depression, well, then the question is, who's there to help you? And are the people who are there to help you, whether it's family or maybe some therapists or teachers, do they know about a lot of stuff? It's so hard to know who to go to. If you go to your local pediatrician, plenty of times, this isn't what they do. If you go to your local school, they have their own picture of what they think is right, and they certainly don't want to pay for more than whatever they think is right. If you go to your insurance company and say, what are the treatments? Again, everybody's got their own piece of the pie. I think the richest, most open sources of information about a lot of treatments are a lot of the advocacy organizations. And certainly Moms Fighting Autism is one. The Autism Society of America is another. Although it's heavily weighted towards the behavioral therapies, but even so, it has plenty of information. The Organization for Autism Research, it's one of the places where I vet research studies for, is fabulous at having a wide range of ideas. In fact, you can download for free their guide to military families, which you don't have to be in military to get the benefit of a lot of their ideas about what are the various things you can do. So if you go to the OAR website and you download the military guide and just look at what they talk about in terms of different treatments for autism. That really is very, very helpful. And then if you're in the military, it's got resources about, you know, other things that might be available to you. A lot of children's hospitals, my own Rady Children's Hospital in San Diego has an autism resource guide that does a very similar kind of thing. It's and I wrote the medication, the floor time part for it, of course. But there's it's probably 60 pages of information. So there are a number of pretty good sources of fairly broad information. I think OAR is good. I think Rady Children's is good. Those are some of the places to go. And you got to find somebody who's willing to kind of walk the walk with you. Clinicians who clearly are listening to you, who you are, and trying to help you make decisions rather than make decisions for you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I want our callers to know that if you're using your telephone to listen today, you can raise your hand and ask a question of Dr. Fader by pressing star 2, and that will let me know that you've raised your hand. Some of the questions that are coming in through the website, Mary in Toronto asks, are there clear assessments for professionals to use for DIR similar to the ABLS, A-B-L-L-S, other than...
Actually, for DIR floor time, there are a couple different instruments to use. There's an assessment instrument called the Functional Emotional Assessment Scale, and it's important to be trained in how to use that, but it's a really nice... In fact, there's a new research version that's just coming out that looks at how people are doing in terms of their ability to regulate, engage, have circles of interaction, be able to have a flow of interaction, use symbolic thinking, then use it logically. It's actually very nice. The other thing that's out there is something called the Social Emotional Growth Curve. It's actually part of the Bayley Scale, which is a very commonly used instrument for looking at child development. And the social emotional growth curve is great. I mean, a pediatrician can put it on, you know, in the chart and just follow someone's social emotional growth through that. It's really very nicely done. It takes just a few minutes for parents to fill out a few things and then for a doctor or other clinician to score it. At ICBL, we also have the clinicians who train with us to learn this model often use sheets that look at these functional, emotional, developmental levels and see how well people are doing and their ability to do these different things. And those are actually available at circlestretch.com. That FEDL sheet is part of, you know, many of the postings and talks there.
May I ask what the name Circle Stretch, where that came from?
Well, we have a mom who made the website for us. I guess I can say her name. She's a public person around here, Marie Goldman. We're very grateful to her. She came up with the name Circle Stretch for our local community website, and it's just a community service website where we post lots of information about DIR floor time. A lot of my talks are there. The other thing that's on there is a whole ton of information about applying DIR floor time type principles in schools, including how you might write goals, how you might train paraprofessionals, lots of that stuff. Most of it comes from my good colleague, Monica Osgood, who's in New Jersey and has a school and program called Celebrate the Children, which is just marvelous. There are probably a dozen or two dozen DIR floor time type schools around the country at this point. And I don't know all of them offhand, but lots of regions of the country have them. We're hoping to do that in Southern California and San Diego. But we haven't gotten that far yet. Mara, my assistant, and Vicki Golden are looking at starting that. So hopefully other people will jump in and do that.
And I think I've been under the false impression that DIR floor time was more for the younger set.
Oh, not at all. In my practice, I see infants through older adults, and I see people at all levels of challenge. So I might be playing with a baby with severe challenges and doing floor time. I might be sitting with an adult CEO of a corporation who's having trouble keeping his marriage together and thinking about those same principles, including affective cueing and repair of interactions. So it's really based on how people develop and learn and communicate, and so it's kind of widely applicable.
Hmm. And it differs from RDI and CERTS. In what way?
Yeah, well, okay, so DIR floor time is so much an overarching biopsychosocial set of principles that talks about these developmental stages, how you get there by paying attention to individual differences and doing it all through relationships. CERTS confines itself a little bit more to autism, I think, to communication as opposed to sort of the wider range of relating and learning and those kinds of things, and doesn't really speak very much to the individual difference piece. That said, I mean, it's gorgeous stuff. RDI also confines itself a little bit more, not paying nearly so specific attention to motor planning. So, for instance, our clinicians are learning about sensor integration and motor planning. They don't become OTs and speech therapists if they aren't. They don't become psychoanalysts if they aren't. But they learn so much about each other's work so that they can work in an interdisciplinary world in a much more fluid manner. So I see RDI as having slices of DIR. I see CERTS as having slices of DIR. And I see DIR floor time as having of kind of the whole umbrella with those things kind of under it, subsumed under it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And parents are trained to implement the program.
Parents, teachers, social coaches. But, yeah, I mean, most kids are with their parents most of the time. And so the question is, there's training and there's training. It's really coaching parents to be able to get from their kids more of those lovely golden moments more of the time where they feel like they're connected and they're really working together to be able to move forward. And whether that's getting their homework done, but in a way that, you know, is comfortable and makes sense, or working on an art project together, or just hanging out in the backyard and running around, but in a way that you're not just chasing someone who's stopping and stimming, but you're really allowing the child to become, or getting yourself into the child's world and becoming part of an interaction. So they're seeking you out, and they really want to play with you, and they really get it that you're part of an interaction.
Mm-hmm. And so many of these interventions and therapies we've been talking about are just cost prohibitive for parents. Where does DIR floor time fall on the scale?
You know, like a lot of therapies, you can spend $1 million or you can spend the cost of a book. So you could go online, for instance, and take an online course from ICDL and learn a lot of the principles and give it a try. Obviously, it helps if you have somebody assisting you. But, you know, for me, give you an example from my practice, there are some people who come in for help and coaching, therapy, you know, a couple times a week, and I'm going to the school and calling the school, and it's pretty involved. There are other people for whom, you know, they might not be able to afford it, or this is what works for them. I'm, you know, seeing a videotape every once in a while, giving them a couple pointers. They come back in a couple months, and we talk about how things are going. So, again, everything has to be titrated to the needs of the family. Another slice of DIR floor time is Rick Solomon's Play Project, which is a kind of a rarefied, manualized floor time version that assumes that the clinicians are paying attention to individual differences and doing a lot of reflective work, but focuses mostly on the parent training for floor time. And the cost, by comparison, for instance, to a ABA-type program, the cost per year, at least out in Michigan, per child is $4,000 per year, as opposed to a lot of ABA-type programs that are more like $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 per year.
Mm-hmm.
So these are, you know, sometimes these interventions can be carried out in an extremely cost-effective way. The question is, are they effective? Are they getting us where they need to go? And actually, Rick's pilot research shows that they are, and he's got a much bigger grant, like a $1.8 million grant, for which the data is going to be coming out in a couple months, prospective study, that I think is going to look really very, very promising. Excuse me. The York University model is a twice-a-week parent coaching model that reportedly, I mean, they have to kind of get the studies, they haven't been published yet, they're in rewrite right now, but reportedly are showing brain changes with coaching twice a week, DIR floor time, with master's-level therapists who are getting some supervision, but the brain changes correspond with clinical changes in the kids. And so the therapists, master's level therapists, are coaching the parents. The parents are doing DIR floor time with their kids a number of hours a week. You know, it's never enough, but, you know, maybe 10, 15, 20 hours a week of that. And then the kids are coming back with functional imaging changes in their brains that are corresponding to clinical changes. It's tremendous. I mean, I can't wait to see that published because that's, you know, obviously going to be very groundbreaking research. So it can be pretty inexpensive and pretty effective, but that doesn't mean that's for everybody. You have to sort of individualize things. So I certainly have people who need plenty of therapies, and they're plenty expensive. And there, you know, we have to try to find funders, whether it's insurance companies using some of the legislative efforts or, governmental sources here or schools or, you know, wherever.
Something that's increasing in popularity here locally is the brain balance centers, interactive metronome, that kind of thing.
I didn't talk about interactive metronome. You know, I've known about that for about, maybe 18 years now. So it's been around. And it's really interesting. It reminds me a lot of kind of a slice of good sensory integration occupational therapy. And again, it's one of those more structured kinds of approaches of, you know, moving in rhythm with, certain metronome rhythms, things like that. I know lots of people who've had it and feel like it's been, you know, pretty beneficial. I like to think that some of our better OT therapies include a lot of attention, and even really DIR floor time has a lot of attention to rhythm and pacing and helps people naturally gain more flexibility and comfort. But I must say that even as a semi-structured treatment, maybe it's that rule of thirds again, maybe even better than that. I know lots of people who just feel like it's been helpful. I haven't seen great research on it, but I have heard lots of people who really, really like it. If you want me to give it a grade, I guess I got to give it a C for lack of clear research. But I'm very intrigued.
All right. Pam from Hacienda Heights asks, cognitive behavioral therapy, what level of cognition must a person have to benefit from this?
That's a great question. And cognitive behavioral therapy was designed for people who could be, you know, fairly thoughtful about, you know, think about their own thinking and their own behaviors and things like that. That said, how much do you really need? There's a great budding literature on cognitive behavioral therapy for children with OCD, depression, anxiety, things like that. One of the better books on the market is by a colleague of mine, John March, out of Duke University, who has some really nice work on cognitive behavioral therapy for OCD in kids. Now, these aren't necessarily kids on the spectrum, and they're typically pretty verbal kids. But I have kids who are responding to cognitive behavioral therapies with some of our local therapists who really are relatively impaired, require special day-type schooling, things like that. They all have, you know, some reasonable verbal abilities, not necessarily fast talking, and they're usually fairly perseverative kids, but I got to tell you, they're responding for their perseverative thoughts often better to that kind of an approach than they are to the medications that I have, which I think I mentioned before, notoriously don't work very well for OCD and autism spectrum disorders. So if you're not verbal, it's hard to use a cognitive behavioral therapy because you're really trying to get people's thoughts. But if you have some thought, it might be okay. Actually, that reminds me of a great joke. You know the joke about the guy who decided to sign himself into the monastery, and after a year, he took a vow of silence. You know this joke?
No, I don't.
It's a good joke because it speaks to this person's question. After a year, they get him in a room and ask him how he's doing. He says, bed hard. So they say, fine, whatever. Another year passes. He's working at the monastery. He comes back. He still has his vow of silence. They ask him how he's doing. And he says, food bad. Okay. Are you sure you haven't heard this joke?
I'm sure.
Okay. So anyway, another year passes. They bring him back again. They say, well, you know, how are you doing? He says, I quit. And they say, well, that makes sense. You've been complaining all along. The point is that if you've got somebody who has symbolic function, meaning that they can use some sort of words to represent some sort of experience, then they have what it takes to potentially use in a cognitive behavioral manner. Now, that takes a lot of finesse, and you have to sort of step back and think about it and understand it. But that said, I've had people who are minimally verbal. I'm thinking of a young adult male who is, you know, very, very afraid of dogs, but we were able to work on that using some engagement and reciprocity, but work with the dog idea as part of a cognitive behavioral piece to our engagement and kind of DIR piece. So again, DIR includes things that include cognitive behavioral approaches. But the fact that he had the ability to use the word dog and know what it meant, and we kind of agreed upon it, made it possible for us to, and had affect associated with that emotion, associated with the word, we could change the emotion associated with the word, which is very powerful. At first, it was fear and anger and frustration with the word dog, and in the end, and it wasn't very long, it was, all right, dog. Instead of dog, it's dog. You know, there's a difference. And so it doesn't necessarily take a whole lot, but you have to sort of figure out how to do it right.
Mm-hmm. Pat from New York asks, do you think that co-treating therapies are good for our neediest students, or should they receive just one therapy at a time?
You know, I think everybody ends up co-treating, you know, with all kinds of therapies. I think the important thing is to coordinate what people are doing and to have some shared goals and lots of communication. So as I said at the end of my talk, having a team focus on engagement and repair of interaction, to me, is the bottom line. So that you're getting together, you're thinking about this, and from all those different angles, in all those different ways, sometimes more structured, sometimes less structured, you're all kind of working towards a similar kind of thing. Now, for some people, a bunch of therapies doesn't work, and it's too much for the family, for the child. So you have to figure that out. But I think most of our kids end up having several therapies. The thing is, how do you work together in a way that you're pulling towards the same goal? There are a lot of people who will say, you know, my therapy is the therapy he needs, other therapies will pollute it, and it won't work. And what I say to that is, you know, I wish I was so certain of how the world works, but I'm pretty sure that things are too complex to rely on one therapy or one therapist to save my child. I just don't buy into that myself. I think that's real. I think there are certainly people who are tremendously helpful, the occasional teacher, therapist, whatever, but I think you don't want to put all your eggs in one basket that way.
Mm-hmm. And then you get the families that are overly passionate about the treatment that their child is getting and try to shove that one down your throat.
Well, you know, I think if something's helping you and your child, how could you not want to tell other people about it? But, yeah, look, I mean, we're in a world, I'm one of them, where our kids might be a little perseverative and we can be a little pushy. All right, you got to cut people slack and sort of, they have your best interests in mind. You know, give them a break if you can. Turn off the phone if you have to.
Mm-hmm. I think I know the answer to this question, and I'd put money on it, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Renee from New Orleans asks, if you had to pick just one therapy which showed the best outcomes, what would you use?
Well, you know, because DIR floor time is such a broad approach, I can say that and pretty much cover all the other therapies because they're subsumed under it. But since you're going to ask me the follow-up question is, you can't cheat, Vader, you have to pick one tiny slice, I'm going to say floor time itself and utilized with a person. Again, because of that critical attention to the moment-to-moment interaction and allowing the child's ideas to float up and again, it can be done in a more structured way if the child needs it. You know, if they're kind of all over the place, you don't want to be just following a kid. But I would say floor time. If I had to pick only, if I only have one thing to do and one thing to teach, it would be floor time.
Is floor time more child-directed?
Oh, by a long shot.
Yeah, child chooses what it wants to do.
Yeah, it's absolutely child-directed. It honors. You know, basically, you play the ball where it lies. The child is doing something, even if they're, you know, just kind of moving their hand in a sort of what apparently useless fashion. they're probably doing that for a reason, maybe regulating themselves in some fashion. You figure out how to become a part of that. You grow it into something else. Or, again, somebody who's not able to talk with you very well, doesn't have good eye contact, has been bullied by kids at school. You're in a room with them. You're kind of thinking about what things are like for them. The floor time, if you will, is you're making statements. You're not asking them a whole bunch of questions. You're saying, wow, you know, I heard things are tough at school. And they're saying, yeah, it's been tough at school, and nobody's really been listening to them. And, you know, it may have a sound of therapy in some fashion, but you're kind of sitting where they're at and letting them expand on the ideas. And you're certainly adding your own ideas and possibilities to their thinking so that they're not just thinking the world is bad and I'm bad, but, gee, I wonder if there are other ways we could solve this so that, you know, you wouldn't be so uncomfortable. So floor time, you know, covers a huge range of function, and it's directed by the other person.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting when you say, you know, you try to rephrase your question and just make an observational statement, because we've been doing RDI with our son, and that was the hardest concept for me to grasp, was to stop asking so many questions.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think people naturally do that. I think our educational system is built on didactics, asking questions, looking for a right answer. The thing about floor time, and it may be different from RDI a lot of times, is that the right answer is infinitely broad. The only wrong answer in my office is something that hurts somebody or breaks something on purpose. Everything else is a right answer, and I roll with it. It's like improv. In improv, if you the idea is to say yes or to respond in an affirmative or affirming way to anything that the other person does. Because the minute you don't do that, it kills the whole interaction, and you lose the developmental thrust. And that's kind of how we think about it. And so to do that, when you ask questions, that tends to cramp down a lot of times people's creativity and makes them feel self-conscious. Better you should make a comment and be wrong and they correct you, which works great, than you should be asking a bunch of questions. That said, I often ask a lot of questions because I need to know medical information, something like that. It's not that I spend the whole time just making statements. But you need to... if you're going to develop an interaction and move it along and help support that person's ability to regulate and communicate and get a flow going and help them develop their and elaborate their ideas, I think you got to try to steer clear of questions.
Mm-hmm. Hard for a mom to do is to shut up.
Mm-hmm. Hard for me to do.
Marianne from Colorado asks, do you think that playing a musical instrument in correct rhythm and time can have the same benefit as a metronome therapy, or is it an entirely different learning process?
I think you'd have to ask the metronome people, but if it's me, I would generally prefer to have somebody who's playing an instrument and playing it well, but able, you know, it's sort of like the difference between Bach and jazz, right? I'd love someone to be able to do some Bach if that regulates them a little bit, but I'm hoping that we can move to jazz or at least Mozart, where there's a little bit of flexibility. But you know, they may be different according to the people who do interactive metronome. I love it when somebody is into a musical instrument that you can use as a vehicle for expanding out into the world. I think interactive metronome probably has less such possibility.
Okay. Sam from Florida asks, what kind of physician or therapist would apply DIR?
Parents, for one, and then any therapist, really. If someone says that they do DIR floor time and they're a therapist, a lot of people will say that. I want people to really try it. I want them to buy books and things like that. But we actually have a very long training process before we at ICDL will say, yeah, you're pretty good at that. And the process takes, you know, many, many years with people looking at your work, and it demands that you be showing your work to people and in communication. So if you have somebody who says they do DI or floor time, ask them who they're talking to about their work. And if they say, well, no, I just know how to do it, then they're actually not doing DI or floor time, because DI or floor time requires that you be talking with other people who do it, who are connected into, you know, the educational system, if you will, the institute system that we have in place. You have, you know, 1,500 people in the country who are part of the institute process at one level or another. So there's always somebody in your state or a state nearby who can be helping you look at your work and develop your work. Everybody's got to be on the path towards looking at their work and being reflective about it, or they're probably not doing it. So the short answer is anybody can do this. The long answer is, if you want me to say you're good at it, you got to show me.
I noticed on the Circle Stretch website that there's a link to videos.
But there are no videos.
Oh, I didn't click on it. I was just going to ask, is there videos people can watch of DIR floor time being implemented?
Yes, there are great videos. If you go to icvl.com, there are links to the YouTube DIR floor time website that has a whole bunch of examples of a DIR floor time. It has lectures from Stan Greenspan kind of explaining the model. Go to icvl.com and kind of go from there. There's also a whole bunch of free webinars and things. But yeah, you can see plenty of video. There's another kind of freelance website called Floor Time Repository that has, I think, thousands of videos at this point. And they're not vetted, so I can't say they're all good. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of examples of pretty good floor time and lots of examples of people trying it out. So that's another great place to check it out as well. But the DIR YouTube channel, in fact, I can probably give you that channel. Give me just half a second here and I'll find it to make it a little bit more clear.
I'm at the ICDL website, and there's a lot of words.
<That's>, yeah.
I like pictures, but there's a lot of information here.
So the YouTube DIR floor time channel is at... youtube.com/user/DIR floor time. So if you just Google up YouTube floor time channel, it's like right there. And there's a whole bunch of Greenspan stuff, probably a bunch of Serena Weider there as well. So that's a great place to start.
Fantastic. I'm going to be up all night now.
Ah.
Well, we are just about out of time. Is there a way that people can contact you if they have more questions?
Yes. My email address, I'm not sure I put it on there. If you go to Circle Search, my email's listed there. But it's jdseder at pol.net, P like Paul, pol.net. You got to give me some time to return emails because I get hundreds per day. But